Okay, we're going to go very quickly over this next story so we can get to the question that Adam was asking. But this is a woman who comes in and does this absolutely amazing thing for Jesus, breaks an alabaster jar of very expensive perfumes, probably worth about a year's wages. Like, so wow. If you think about what your wages are, you can imagine the value of this. Poured it on his head while he's reclining. And the disciples go, what does she think she's doing? Because Jesus has never asked for any luxuries. He didn't ask for an iPhone. He didn't ask for a Maserati. He didn't ask for a bulletproof van to drive around in. Right? He didn't ask for the stuff that the rulers of the world expect. Now, if someone brought a gift like this for King Charles, it'd be normal. That's what you give a king. But because Jesus never asked for anything like this, the disciples go, what a wasteful woman. And Jesus has to stop them and go, you don't realize she's done something beautiful for me. She has honored me. And I want you to know that she's done far more than what she is aware. Because within a week, you won't have my body here to pour anything on anymore. It'll be gone. She's anointed me in preparation for my burial. This is an act of honor. Where she's recognized, why are you criticizing her? Give her a break, guys. Simply because Jesus doesn't demand this stuff, his disciples thought he didn't deserve it. So I think it's important for us to realize that people can do extravagant things. And I'm not suggesting that building a cathedral or doing something extravagant is always the right thing. I'm not suggesting that. But let's just not be ready to critique and condemn. Oh, goodness, we're getting back to that again. That's what they're doing. They're critiquing and condemning her for something that she has done that's actually really beautiful, that Jesus takes as a memorial for his life. And then he says, it's actually a memorial for her life as well. This is the most important thing this woman ever did. It's the only thing we know. How many thousands of people did Jesus meet? I mean, absolutely nothing about them. But we know about this woman because she did something amazing to recognize Jesus as her king. So this story will be told as a memorial to her because she offered it as a memorial for Jesus. So this, whatever we do for Jesus flows over as a memorial beyond what we've just done for him and becomes something for his people as well. Beautiful, beautiful story. I like to wonder whether any of this perfume was still noticeable when Judas came up, put his arms around Jesus to hug him in the garden, when he stood before the high priest and had the high priest condemning him, when he stood before Pilate, when he hung, I wonder if the perfume of something beautiful, a recognition of his kingship, stuck with him over the next few days. Because I think it was the kind of perfume that could stick around for a while. But not everyone thinks Jesus is worth that. The contrast is what Judas thinks Jesus is worth. What did Judas think Jesus was worth? 30 silver coins was the price of a slave in the Old Testament law. If you had an animal that accidentally killed a neighbor's slave, you had to pay compensation of 30 pieces of silver. It was the value of a slave. An absolute insult if Jesus is king. And it's not even what Judas thinks he's worth, it's what the temple leaders think Jesus is worth. Judas offers to betray Jesus, and he doesn't even set a price, and he doesn't bargain for Jesus. They offer him, they think, oh, well, price of a slave, that'll do. And that's what they offer him, and Judas takes it. Judas just traded the source of life for something less. It's hardly surprising that Judas finishes up with nothing left but death.
A bit hard when you're chosen to carry this out, because basically looking back on history in the public, that person, whoever it was going to do that.
I don't think he was chosen.
Don't think God chose him? Think he chose?
No, chose Judas to do it.
Yeah. We can get into a big theology of election associated with that. I would like to suggest that Judas was culpable for his actions, that he was making this choice, that something went wrong. I don't know exactly what, but he was disillusioned with Jesus, like John the Baptist was when John said, "Are you the one who was to come?" Or, you know, he got this disillusionment, and he went to the leaders in Jerusalem and offered to trade Jesus for whatever they would offer him. So he'd become disillusioned with Jesus. Now, he didn't think Jesus deserved death. So he's a bit cheesed off when he sees that Judas is going to get killed because he didn't intend that. But he's still a culpable human being, I think, rather than a God-chosen traitor.
Oh, I wasn't looking at that. I was just wondering why.
All right. Let's get down to the section on the Last Supper then. This is on page 179 of your notes. And I don't want to take a little bit of time associated with this. It was the first day of unleavened bread. Now, that's a term for Passover week. During Passover week, even today in Jewish households, all the rising agents are completely cleaned out of the house, so there's nothing like that, and for a week it's unleavened bread week. Disciples came to Jesus to ask, "Where would you like us to make the preparations for the Passover meal?" So this is Passover week. Jesus has chosen this week, Passover week, in part because all the people are there, in part because of what Passover stands for in the Jewish calendar. It was the celebration of the time when God brought Pharaoh's authority down, freed his people so that they could come under Yahweh's authority, and Yahweh became their king. So the whole Sinai covenant was a commitment to Yahweh that Yahweh would rule them. He would give them their law. They would be his nation. He would be their ruler. And he had to save them from oppressive human rule so they could come under divine rule. That's what Passover was celebrating. So he tells them, head into the city to that person's place. It's an unnamed person. And say to him, "The teacher says, my time is close. With you, I will hold the Passover with my disciples." And the disciples did as Jesus directed them and prepared the Passover. When evening came, he was seated with the 12. And as he ate with them, he said, "Truly, one of you will hand me over." I'm translating the word betray as handover because there are passages where that phrase becomes really important. Judas hands Jesus over to the temple authorities. The temple authorities hand him over to Pilate, and Pilate hands him over to death. So there's this multiple handovers as Jesus' authority is smashed to pieces by one of his own people, the leaders of God's people, the oppressors of God's people, and ultimately death itself. That's how the handing over leads to Jesus' death. Jesus is aware that one of the 12 is betraying him, and by this stage he knows who that actually is. The other 11 are deeply distressed, and they're saying, "Surely not me, Master." And Jesus replied, "The one who's dipping his hand in the dish with me will hand me over." Now, the attitude that Jesus has is phenomenal. If I was being betrayed by somebody, I would be standing up and coming down on somebody like a ton of bricks and backing away with horror to create the impression that this person needs to be, you know. And it's not what Jesus does. What Jesus does, he sits around the table with them, is he takes a piece of bread and he leans in and it says, "It's the one I'm sharing my bread with." It's the grief of wanting to have fellowship, wanting to have connection with someone he's trusted and known and eats so many meals with, but he's not attacking and condemning. He's looking for any way that he can bridge that gap. And in this case, it's not possible. That tells you the king's heart. Any other king I ever heard of who heard about an assassination plot, off with his head. Herod, John the Baptist, you know. Jesus is looking to see, is there any way we can reconcile this? And there isn't. Because not everybody can be reached. And as you seek to reconcile with people in your world, if you have that heart that Jesus had at that table, looking for the way to reconcile. So precious, so gospel driven, so heart of heaven. But I can't promise it'll always work. There's no guarantee that other person will respond. And Judas doesn't. So then, Jesus begins to describe to them what this will mean, the significance of his cross, and what they're about to see. On the top of page 179, we have what I've titled the Covenant Meal. Who are we up to? Whose turn is to read? 26 to 29.
As he ate with them, Jesus took some bread and offered a blessing. He broke it and gave it to his disciples, saying, "Take and eat, this is my body." Taking a cup and offering thanks, he gave it to them, saying, "Drink from it, all of you, for this is my blood of the covenant being poured out for many for cancellations of sin. I tell you, from this moment I will not drink the vine's produce with you until the day when I drink it with you anew in my Father's kingdom."
Okay. So, what is my blood of the covenant? What is that about? Yes, this is Passover. But Passover led to Sinai, where God made a covenant with his people. The covenant that he would be their sovereign and they would be his nation, the people under divine management. How that worked in the book of Exodus was that at Mount Sinai, God announced the Ten Commandments and then gave the rest of the terms of the covenant in Exodus chapters 21, 22, and 23. In Exodus 24, God said to Moses, "Right, ask the people if they're happy to enter into this covenant that will make God king and make them his people." When they said, "Yes, we are," Moses took blood and sprinkled it on the people and said to them, "This is the blood of the covenant that makes you God's people." Just going to pop Exodus 24 on screen, because this is the phrase that Jesus is using. Okay? So the people say in verse 3, "Everything the Lord has said we will do." They commit to the covenant. They make the covenant commitment. And Moses prepares blood in the bowls. That's how things were done back in the ancient world. In verse 8, he took the blood of the covenant, sprinkled it on the people. What that does is mark them as God's people. And he said to them, "This is the blood that's been sprinkled over you that marks the covenant, the blood that identifies you as the covenant people, where Yahweh is sovereign and you are the people under his leadership. The blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with these words." So Jesus isn't just doing a Passover meal. Jesus is doing a new covenant meal. Just as Sinai made Israel God's people in Old Testament times, because they were sprinkled with the blood that Moses put on them, what's about to happen as the world kills Jesus, the bloodshed of assassinating God's king, will establish a new covenant between God and not just Israel, but all the peoples of the earth. We talked about how many times Jesus is referring to Zechariah. In Zechariah, we have that phrase crop up again. "Because of the commitment, the blood commitment that I made to you at Sinai, I will redeem you. I will send you my king," Zechariah says. And then Jesus picks up on the phrase from Zechariah that's reflected in from Exodus and says, "This is what I'm doing. This is establishing a new covenant." So it's not just a Passover meal. It's a new covenant meal that the earth now belongs under Jesus, despite the fact that the earth has assassinated God's Messiah. Despite the bloodshed of killing God's son, God will raise him up and use this last rebellion to finally restore the earth. So the bloodshed of Jesus leads to the new covenant, where the whole world and all the nations and all the peoples of the earth belong under divine kingship.
So would it be accurate to draw the parallel with Israel being under the oppression of Pharaoh, liberated,
yes. Yes.
Come under the authority of Yahweh,
yes.
Sprinkled with the blood, this is the new covenant. Now, our time, we're under the oppression of sin and death,
yes.
Liberated under the kingship of Jesus,
yes.
Sprinkled with his blood,
yes.
In the new covenant.
And therefore marked as the people of God under divine kingship. That's how it works. So it's not just a Passover meal, it's a new covenant meal. A meal that celebrates the new covenant. Kind of like a wedding breakfast, if you like. You know how when there's a new covenant between a man and a woman, they get married, they make this commitment to each other, we will do life together. And then you have a meal, a wedding breakfast that celebrates the covenant that was just made and everybody joins in. And there's a covenant meal at Sinai. And I think this is one of the most amazing passages in the Old Testament. Because what happens after they've been sprinkled with the blood that identifies them as God's people, they've said yes to the covenant, they are now the covenant people of God, is God's in residence on Mount Sinai, and he invites them to come and have a meal with him. Verse 9, Moses, Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, and the other 70 elders of Israel went up, and they saw the God of Israel. The God who's been talking to Moses on the mountain, they get to see God. Now, I don't think they saw God's face. They saw God passing over the top of the heavens. And they probably saw like footprints of God rather than the face of God, right? Because under his feet was something like a pavement of a precious blue stone, the color of the sky. Bright blue is the sky. But the amazing thing is that they've been invited into God's house because they belong there now. Because of the covenant, they are the people who sit at God's table and eat of his provision every day. And God did not raise a hand against these leaders because they belonged there because of the covenant that they've just made. So they saw God and they ate and drank. That's the covenant meal that Jesus is referring to. And he says to the disciples, I'm in this meal establishing with you a new covenant meal because I won't have the chance to do it again. I'm about to be killed and I won't have the chance to eat this with you again until I'm resurrected, until God's kingship is established. So back to Matthew 26 and verse 28. This cup that you're drinking is the blood of a new covenant because my blood is about to be shed tomorrow because of the sin of the world. And what I'm doing will in fact cancel out the sins of the world. And I'm telling you, I won't have the chance to have this new covenant meal with you again until the day when we are sharing it together in my Father's kingdom. And I don't think he means sometime a long, long, long time in the future, because according to Acts chapter 1, Jesus sat down and had meals with the disciples after he was resurrected. So I think he's talking about when he would come back after his blood had been shed. And the kingship was entrusted to him. And they would share in the new covenant meal regularly, as we do today. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, beautiful. Completely different to that idea of to appease God, someone had to die. The animals had
totally
to die, Jesus had to die.
Yep.
That pagan idea.
Just pick up where that phrase is echoed in Zechariah. That phrase is only in Scripture in the Old Testament, in Exodus 24 and in Zechariah 9. It's only two places in the Old Testament where you'll find that phrase, the blood of the covenant. You'd recognize this passage, Zechariah 9:9, king riding into Jerusalem on a donkey to make peace where there had previously been war. As for you, the blood of the covenant with you, the word my is not in Hebrew, because of the blood of the covenant with you, because of the divine commitment that God has, where he doesn't fail, even when the people do, I will free your prisoners from the waterless pit. I will set you free. God speaking to Israel. Many of the Old Testament prophets talk about the new covenant. Jeremiah 30:31, Ezekiel talks about it. God does this thing in Jesus and frees not just Israel, but the whole world. As the kingdom of God, under divine kingship, it's a new covenant that restores the whole world. So the new covenant in Christ not only fulfills the Sinai covenant, it fulfills the Noah covenant when God made a commitment to all the peoples of the earth. The whole world coming under Christ as a new covenant relationship where the whole world is God's kingdom in the Messiah. We're making sense?
Yeah, just one question. Is it, you know, without the shedding of blood, there's no remission of sins. So was the blood significant per se, or was it Jesus laying down his life that was the significant?
Jesus laying down his life is what we're talking about. Jesus voluntarily putting himself in the position where he can be harmed is the means by which we are liberated. The quotation from Hebrews is from the Old Testament law, where the life is in the blood, and that was how the old covenant operated. So why would you be surprised if Jesus dies and God uses that to rescue us, is the point that Hebrews is making. I know that's not the way it's always been taught, but I think that's what Hebrews is doing. All right, let's try to finish off this last few bits. Verse 30, when they had sung a hymn. Ah, how many times have we heard about Jesus and the disciples singing in the book of Matthew? This is the only one. It's mentioned in Mark's gospel as well, but this is the only occasion when Jesus and the disciples are described as singing. When we get together at church, we always sing. It's like half the church service is taken up with singing in a lot of places. What?
Yes.
Why are we doing that? I mean, we have a lot of musical instruments. We have a big PA system. And they hardly ever did it. Are we majoring on a minor here? Are we sort of like got the emphasis different? Is worship really about singing, or is singing just one little tiny part and worship is actually much bigger than that? I'll leave you with that. We need to touch on Peter's denial. Jesus said to them, you're all going to fall. You will, it's actually a passive tense, you will be felled, like someone falling a tree. You'll be felled on account of me tonight. And when they want to know why Jesus thinks that, he says, well, that's how Zechariah told the story. He said, strike the shepherd and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. Now, again, it's a very cryptic use of a verse in the book of Zechariah. Zechariah was probably talking about what happened in the lead up to the exile. The northern kingdom of Israel had already been felled, and Babylon was coming, and King Josiah, the last good king of Israel, the last God-appointed king of Judah, the next three were appointed by Egypt and Babylon, the last God-appointed king was killed in a battle against Pharaoh. He was felled. The shepherd of God's people, the God-appointed shepherd, died, and then the sheep all went into exile pretty soon after that. And that phrase from Zechariah, Jesus picks up and says, you know, that's going to happen again, don't you? The God-appointed shepherd of God's people, the anointed, the Christ, the king God's provided for his people, is once again going to be felled, because that's the nature of sin in the world. The rulers of the world want to kill the kings, and that's how they gain power. So when Josiah was killed, Judah became a puppet state of Egypt, and then Egypt fell to Babylon, and Judah was taken over and became puppet. That's how the rulers of the world operate. They kill the rulers that God has appointed. It's happened so many times before. It's going to happen again tomorrow. Zechariah is wrestling with, how can this happen if he's God's anointed? And his answer to the question is, well, God must have authorized it. God has authorized Josiah to be killed, because nothing can happen unless God authorizes it. So God must have authorized for Jesus to be killed. And when he does, his little flock will be scattered. But don't imagine for a minute that's the end of the kingship. Jesus is the one who restores the fallen kingship. So when I have risen, I will go ahead of you to Galilee. Remember that phrase next week, will you? We're going to need to remember that one. And then we finish up at Gethsemane. Oh my goodness. If any of you have ever wrestled with God in prayer over stuff that doesn't make any sense, this chapter is an incredible encouragement for you. We haven't got time to go through this in detail, but essentially what Jesus is doing is he's aware that he's going to be killed the next day. Now, any other person would be fleeing from Jerusalem the way David did when his son was trying to kill him, Absalom. Jesus doesn't flee. Well, what's he staying for? Is he going to fight? No, he's not going to fight. Flight and fight. No, he doesn't choose either option. He stays. There is a third option. Fight or flight, or stay and die. Not a very attractive option, but it's the one Jesus chooses. So how does he handle his last hours, wrestling with what it means to stay and die. Is it a fight or flight? He goes to talk to his father about this and says, this makes no sense. We've heard the voice of God a couple of times, and every time he said, this is my son whom I love. Right? Tonight he goes and says, Father, why have I got a poisoned chalice to drink? Why are you allowing these people to give me a cup that will kill me? I don't want to drink this thing. I'll do it if you want. But is this what you as my father want me to do? If you have ever wrestled with a question like that in prayer, you'll understand something of the horror Jesus was facing. Of course, the others have got no idea what's happening. They're asleep. Jesus is trying to tell them it's not safe tonight. But all their life they've known Jesus was safe, right? When there was a big storm, Jesus was asleep in the boat. Jesus, wake him up. He goes, what were you afraid for? Because Jesus is there, they feel safe. But this night it's not safe. Jesus is telling them it's not safe tonight. So they're sleeping and he's not. He's disturbed. He's in anguish of soul. He can't make any sense out of what's happening. It's not that he's lost his faith. It's just that stay and die is not a very attractive option. And it's the option he's got. So why are you giving me this cup to drink, Father? You're still there having that conversation with God. Well, more of a monologue, actually. Because tonight God doesn't answer. Tonight there's no voice from heaven saying, it's because you're my son. It's just silence. It's so hard to cope with when God doesn't say anything. And eventually, Judas arrives with the temple guard to arrest Jesus. Betrays him. The guard with their clubs and swords, and Jesus says, there's something wrong with this picture. The people who are meant to be representing God are coming out in the dark with swords and clubs to fight. Does that strike you as being odd? Is that representing God's reign? Peter pulls out his sword. Again, this is pretty awkward. Peter takes a swipe and chops off somebody's ear. Now, I don't think Peter goes like this and tries to, can I get the guy's ear right? He's not doing that. Peter's taking a swing and he's coming for the guy's head. And the guy ducks his head and he slices. I mean, Peter's serious about this. Peter's trying to kill the guy. And Jesus says, put that sword away. Those who live by the sword are killed by the sword. The sword destroys those who use it. If you know anyone who's been in the armed forces, they know what that's like. They come back from a war zone. And the death is not over. They're still losing friends to shell shock or suicide. Because those who live by the sword are destroyed by the sword. You can't save the world that way. You can only save the world with this non-defensive posture that Jesus has taken, the reason he hasn't run or fought. And he won't allow us to run or fight either. So we might have to learn how to face evil in the world without feeling like we have to fight it or flee from it. And some of us lose ourselves as we do that. Just like many of the disciples themselves lost their lives. So Jesus confronts the leaders. He is not acting like a rebel, the way these leaders are, the temple leaders. He is being obedient to God, even though it's the toughest thing you can possibly imagine. And then finally, the Sanhedrin condemns Jesus to death because they force him to answer the question, are you the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God? They're not asking about the Trinity. They're asking about his kingship. Remember this? This is the confession Peter made. And Jesus answers your words. You've said it. But I tell you what, you're going to see God giving the Son of Man the kingship. And that's enough for them to want to kill him. So the confrontation between the temple and the king comes to the main point here in Matthew 26:64, as they condemn him for claiming to be God's Messiah. Friends, we're out of time for chapter 26. I've rushed through that last little bit. Is that okay? We'll just have to leave it at that for the sake of time tonight. We're right out of time. So next week we'll pick up chapter 27, which is the description of the crucifixion, and chapter 28, which is the description of the resurrection. But did that actually make sense of the atonement? The reconciliation of heaven and earth, when earth did the worst thing it possibly could, killing God's anointed ruler. And God rescued the earth ultimately by raising up and giving him the kingship anyway. That's grace. That's God never walking away. So we'll talk about that next week.